Conversations in Healthcare. I'm Mark Masella.
And I'm Margaret Flint.
Margaret, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Mark.
And it's a good new year for Congress and for the American public as Congress finally passed the new tax deal called the American Taxpayer Relief Act.
And the New Year's Day cliffhanger about the fiscal cliff had everybody on edge, Mark. And you know, it's a little sad. It comes down to a robbing Peter to pay Paul sort of compromise, I think.
You know, you're absolutely right about that. In the backroom deal, it was worked out between the Vice President, Joe Biden, and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, two old friends from the Senate. Tax credits to the middle class have been permanently extended, and the deal also postpones for 2 months the so-called sequester of automatic spending cuts.
And I noticed that there was a report that on the annual list of three phrases that should be banned from English language, one was fiscal cliff, and a second was kicking the can down the road, which sounds like exactly what's been done for the next 2 months. But it does avert the expected 27% drop in reimbursements to physicians who treat Medicare patients. I don't think any of us believe that was actually going to happen. It extends current Medicare payment rates through the end of the year. But some of that deal came at the cost of cutting Medicare payments to hospitals and dialysis centers. So not everybody's happy about that.
You're right. And there was some compromising in the House, and the Senate agreed to raise the tax rates on Americans making more than $450,000 per year. President Obama said in a brief news conference that the fiscal cliff agreement will help to raise about $620 billion a year. The White House refused to accept a deal that would cut expenditures in the Affordable Care Act or to beneficiaries.
Well, with the deficit reduction discussion still looming in 2013, let's hope that the newly elected Congress finds more common ground in the months ahead than in the year behind us. This dysfunction has just been unacceptable to the American people.
You're absolutely right. And our guest today has a handle on how Americans are functioning more and more with their use of the internet, tablets, and smartphones.
Susanna Fox is the Associate Director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project. She's been studying the intersection of the internet and healthcare in this country for well over a decade.
She has a fascinating take on how information technology is really changing the way Americans consume healthcare. And FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson checks in with another correction on the public comment made about healthcare.
And remember, in 2013, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And if you have comments, please email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
Now we'll get to our interview with Susanna Fox in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Amid pressure, the House passed a fiscal deal ending a climatic fiscal showdown. In the final hours of the 112th Congress, the House late Tuesday passed and sent to President Obama legislation to avert big income tax increases on most Americans and prevent large cuts in spending for the Pentagon and other government programs, including health care. In approving the measure after days of legislative intrigue, Congress concludes its final and most pitched fight over fiscal policy, the culmination of 2 years of battles over taxes, federal debt, spending, and what to do to slow the growth in popular social programs like Medicare. But the compromise bill, which blocked most impending tax increases and postponed spending cuts largely by raising taxes on upper-income Americans, left a host of unresolved issues that will have to be decided in 2013. And recess apparently should be considered one of the essential R's in education. American Journal of Pediatrics came out with a report citing recess as an absolute essential part of the learning equation, removed from many schools in recent years in favor of more teaching to standardized tests and such. New analysis shows recess allows students to process information better. Exercise helps them metabolize the foods they eat in school. And also they eat less if they exercise before going to lunch. And 'tis the season for New Year's resolutions and the month when the highest number of folks sign up at the gym or at the local weight loss center. But here's news you can use if you're a little fluffy. People with a BMI of 25 to 30 who are considered overweight and make up more than 30% of the U.S. population have a 6% lower risk of death than those with BMIs in a normal range of 18.5 to 25. That, according to a study published this past week in the Journal of American Medical Association. However, it suggests you don't give up your plans to reduce that weight and keep regular exercise as part of your everyday health experience. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're We're speaking today with Susanna Fox, Associate Director of the Pew Research Center's Internet in American Life Project, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization which studies the social impact of the Internet. Ms. Fox is a leading analyst at the intersection between technology and healthcare and has been charting the growth of social network and health information sharing for a dozen years. She's a regular contributor to ePatients.net and was an editor at U.S. News and World Report. Susanna, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
You know, you've been analyzing and compiling data on a steady growth of the Internet and its intersection with healthcare for the past dozen years, but you've focused on the specific area, the social life of health information. Let our listeners know what you mean by the social life of health information and connect the dots of why it's so important to understand this if we want to see patients achieve better health outcomes.
When we started our research back in the year 2000, only about half of American adults had access to the Internet. Only 5% had broadband. And the Internet was really seen back then as a slow, stationary information vending machine. You went up to it, you asked a question, and it gave you back the beginnings of an answer. What we see now with the rise of smartphones and broadband is that people expect to get so much more from the Internet. And they expect to be able to have the answers right in their pocket or in their purse. And that changes our relationship with information so that people now not only have access to information, but they have access to each other. And in healthcare, that means that there is always access to somebody who is just ahead of you on a treatment path. Someone who maybe just had a baby and can tell you about how it went. What we see in our research is that 1 in 5 Internet users say they have looked online for someone like them, and that increases if we just focus on people who are living with a chronic disease. 1 in 4 Internet users living with a chronic condition say they have looked online for someone like me. So the social life of health information is in this sharing that's going on, that's available night and day, wherever you are.
So, Susanna, here we are. People are accessing health information online. Mobile technologies are going to move us even further in this arena. What's your thoughts on how this impacts how people will actually access health care?
I need to talk a little bit about the 3 revolutions that we've actually seen now. The first revolution was broadband. And I mentioned that back in the year 2000, only 5% of American households had it. Now up to 2/3. The second revolution was the mobile revolution. We're now up to 88% of American adults who have a cell phone. Half of those are smartphones, which can access the Internet. And the third revolution is social networking. We're now up to 2/3 of Internet users who are now using social networking sites like Facebook and LinkedIn. And older adults are actually the fastest growing group. What this means for healthcare is that people are expecting to have access to information and to each other and to services anytime, wherever they are. That means that people are starting to look at what kinds of services they can get online. And so healthcare service providers would do well to look at other industries that have been disrupted already, such as banking and travel, and even the news business, because that's what we've seen over the last decade here at the Pew Research Center, that as those industries have been forced to change, they have been forced to take into account these 3 revolutions of broadband, mobile, and social. And so those are the areas that I'm looking at in terms of healthcare delivery. How can healthcare delivery take advantage, not just be blindsided, but really take advantage of the revolutions that have changed the information and communications landscape?
I want to pull the thread on your earlier statement that 1 out of 5 of the people who were searching the Internet were looking for someone like them or someone like me. And we've had a couple of health information pioneers on our show who've been developing services, it seems. And we've had e-patient Dave DeBroncart, who fought for the right to gain access to his own medical records and launched a movement. And Jamie Haywood, founder of the data sharing site Patients Like Me. So tell us more about these e-patient trends. You've been studying at Pew. How are they impacting the medical community and healthcare in general?
Just as we saw broadband go from a tiny fraction of the population to now two-thirds of American households, we're seeing the same thing, the beginning of a trend where there's always been a small group of patients who were willing to dig in, who asked for their medical records. Maybe they didn't receive them, who wanted to get involved in the research to help save their own lives or the lives of their loved ones. And for many, many years, they did not have access to the tools that could really help them to contribute. And now they do. What we're seeing now is that sites like Patients Like Me are giving powerful tools to the people with the most at stake, patients and the people who love them. And what I've seen in my research is that you really don't want to stand in between the mother of a child with a rare condition and information that will save that child's life. And the internet can be a secret weapon in that long, long journey, even just to get to a diagnosis. And the internet can amplify the behaviors that all of us do anyway. It's very human to want to share what's going on in our lives and to compare notes with a neighbor or someone who's going through the same thing. And what the internet allows us to do is to broaden our neighborhood to include the whole world so that anyone who feels rare and alone in their diagnosis doesn't have to be anymore. And Patients Like Me gives people the tools to not only find each other, but Patients Like Me allows people to track, to measure, and compare across this wider neighborhood so that they can go toe-to-toe with scientists and with clinicians and say, what I have here is my daily log of symptoms and how this particular drug is affecting me and 100 other people who have my same condition.
Well, Suzanne, I want to pick up on that trend of self-tracking, not just for the rare and most unusual conditions, but really people are using their phone and internet apps to track everything from their calorie intake to glucose levels, even tracking their moods as they manage various chronic illnesses. And I understand you're keynoting an event on this topic on what the future looks like for self-tracking. So with all the innovation, the thousands of apps available, but still no one platform to easily interface between patients and their healthcare providers, what's your sense of how this tracking ultimately is affecting people's health? And I always ask that other question, are you sure anybody's home on the other side in terms of the provider offices with being able to have the time and the attention and the tools to make use of that data in a meaningful way?
Well, you've put your finger on a perennial issue with the internet and technology and healthcare, and that is we continually see two silos growing up in parallel. And one is on the patient side, where patients are starting to have access to these powerful tools of self-tracking and networking within their own communities. And on the other side, we have this push towards electronic medical records. But again, it's very rare to see the two silos connect.
We're speaking today with Susanna Fox, Associate Director of the Pew Research Center's Internet and the American Life Project, funded by the Pew Charitable Trust. She's been analyzing trends at the intersection of technology and healthcare for over a dozen years. Now, Susanna, you focused quite a bit on research on another way people are utilizing the internet in healthcare, and that's tracking patient safety issues. Tell us about your findings that you were able to share on the potential social media has in the area of patient safety.
Our research indicates that many people are looking for ways to educate themselves about issues like what can they expect as they go into a new diagnosis or a new treatment. What we find is that 80% of internet users are doing this type of research online. 20% are contributing reviews about hospitals, about doctors, and they're also posting their own personal stories about what happened to them when they went through a treatment. Now, that's actually about what we'd expect given the Pareto principle, which is the 80-20 rule, that 80% of the audience is just listening, and 20% is contributing. But what's really interesting is that the two revolutions that I mentioned, the mobile revolution and the social networking revolution, are starting to have an effect on that. That when you hand someone a smartphone, they're more likely to contribute to the conversation online. So as you watch the spread of smartphones throughout the population, think about what it will mean when everyone who has something to share about an experience at a certain hospital or with a certain clinician or with a certain drug, what if they had the means to share it? And the other really interesting trend that we're watching is something we call the diagnosis difference, that it also makes a difference when someone has a chronic condition. They are more likely to contribute to these online review sites that review hospitals and clinicians and drugs. As more people with chronic conditions go online, what's going to happen? Is there going to be an opportunity for more sharing? And will that principle of more people listening than contributing change?
Well, Susanna, certainly one of the most accessible connecting tools that plays into all of this is texting. And a recent guest on our show, BJ Fogg from Stanford, had made the observation that texting far exceeds any other platform in terms of eliciting an instant response. Tell us about your research on the growth of texting and its emerging power as a tool that facilitates patient engagement with each other as well as with their providers.
88% of American adults have a cell phone, and that's also pretty high among teenagers. And I bring up teenagers, of course, because they are the champions at texting. And we've even seen in our research, just looking at teens, there's a wonderful quote by a teen who said, "Email is for old people." That this teenager literally only uses email if they are communicating
with their parents,
with a teacher or a parent. And that really, if you want to reach a teenager, then you need to send them a text. Some research was done in the Netherlands that showed that when someone receives a text, they're likely to open it within the first 2 or 3 minutes of receiving it. And I've heard that called the FedEx principle. You know, the idea is that when the mail arrives, maybe you look at it, but when a FedEx arrives, you open it right away. It must be something important. And that's still true of text messages. You know, your phone buzzes, you're interested, you wonder who it is, you can't resist, and you look at it. There was a study that was done by the Center for Connected Health in text message reminders to people who have had skin cancer. At 7 a.m. every day, the dermatologist would send a text message with the weather report reminding the person to put on sunscreen. And what they found is that those text messages were very likely to be opened. And they gave them a tube of sunscreen that had a cap that sent a message back to the researchers if the cap was opened, which meant that the person was putting on sunscreen. And they increased compliance of putting on sunscreen by, I think, 20%. It's that text message that can reach the person instantly. You can imagine how that might be used in other healthcare contexts.
So, Susanna, you had the opportunity to attend Wesleyan University, which is right here in our backyard, and you talk about it in your talks of the encounter that you had with a freshman geology professor who really altered your way of thinking. You call yourself an internet geologist. Now, there are other technologies that are changing the landscape of healthcare, and you've surveyed other trends like the future of robotics in the integrated networks in healthcare. Tell us about other trends you've analyzed in that area that are poised to transform healthcare.
Pew Internet does a series of reports about the future, and we elicit responses from experts all across different fields. And what we do is give them a tension pair where we ask them to think about what the future might hold, where we make a prediction. And that's where we get some really, really interesting insights. And indeed, we are seeing that people are, in general, quite hopeful about technology, even in healthcare. Healthcare is a sector that, frankly, has been quite slow to change, but we are now starting to see a recognition that technology can be useful. I guess what I'm really interested in is tapping into the power of networks. I think, you know, there's some fabulous things going on in terms of long-distance care and robotics. I am personally very interested in the daily choices that people make that make the difference in avoiding hospitalization and what people can learn from each other. So I'm just very much interested in the velocity of the social interaction that comes from ubiquitous broadband, ubiquitous mobile, and ubiquitous social networking.
We've been speaking today with Susanna Fox, Associate Director of the Pew Research Center Internet and American Life Project, which studies the social impact of the Internet and the intersection between technology and healthcare. Susanna, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations today.
Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, now that President Obama has been reelected, we believe there's been a resurgence of viral email traffic related to the Affordable Care Act, at least judging by the questions readers have been sending to us. Several readers have asked whether the law was going to limit care for seniors or anyone, whether it's dialysis or care after a stroke. But the law doesn't dictate what medical treatment anyone can get. These claims are reminiscent of the old death panel claims. One old chain email from 2009, before the law was even passed, said that, quote, a government committee will decide what treatments you get. But the claim referred to an advisory committee that would recommend what minimum benefits all insurance plans would have to cover. We've seen several attempts to cast the law as a way to limit medical care, but they're not true. Other claims have referred to a panel that is tasked with recommending ways to slow the growth in Medicare spending. The law specifically says that panel can't ration health care. Our advice for the public has long been to simply delete viral emails, which normally peddle misinformation and bogus claims. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Barry Katz's wife was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, it began a four-year odyssey of treatments, of illness, ultimately her passing. With two daughters to raise and a business to run, Barry found the role of caregiver all the more challenging as his wife became sicker. He was preparing for a daughter's bat mitzvah and a business launch when he learned that his wife's battle was nearing the end. In desperation, he reached out to family for help, and it arrived instantly. He decided he would use his family's experience to launch a new business venture, one that would help other families going through what he had. His idea? LotsOfHelpingHands.com, an online platform that brings communities together to help caregivers dealing with loved ones in a crisis. What Barry found was you can be overwhelmed with offers for help or not have enough people reaching out to help when you really need it. Whether it's a family caring for a special needs child, a parent with Alzheimer's, or a wounded veteran, Lots of Helping Hands allows caregivers to set up an online community of volunteers who can do everything from helping provide family meals to taking a patient to treatment to making sure a child gets picked up at school. Since founding Lots of Helping Hands 5 years ago, 750,000 volunteers have helped 25,000 people around the world. Families set up online communities with calendars and volunteers pledge online for a specific task. Barry's design of the site was intended to ensure several things. that it would always be free to those who use it, that it would be an intuitive site to navigate, and that it provided a robust platform for feedback. The tens of thousands of testimonials speak volumes about its success, with most saying, essentially, that in the most troubling time of need, lots of helping hands helped make the unbearable bearable. An online portal that brings volunteers who want to help together with caregivers who desperately need their help. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University. Streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.